we last left Christian as he had been assisted out of the swamp of despond. And now, with the remnants of the swamp still covering him, Christian is back on his way to the wicket gate. This is where we are introduced to the next character in our story. We, the readers, are told from the very beginning that the next character's name is Mr. Worldly Wise Man. You'll pick up from the story, if you read the story, perhaps you picked up already that Christian never really knew who he was engaged in a conversation with until later when evangelist explained to him, "The man whom you spoke with is Mr. Worldly Wise Man." But we're told at the very beginning that he's talking to a man named Mr. Worldly Wise Man. And if you have any biblical knowledge at all, you probably want to tap the brakes on the conversation or counsel if you're ever talking to someone with that last name or first name. Initially, there's two things we learn about Mr. Worldly Wise Man. First, he's from the town of Carnal Policy. And also that he already had a prior knowledge of the fact that Christian had departed the city of destruction. And when Mr. Worldly Wise Man approaches Christian, we're told that he immediately took control of the conversation by asking Christian a series of five questions. The first one is, "Where are you going in such a burdened manner?" Notice how he took note and he showed concern for Christian. When Christian told him where he was going and why to get this burden off of his back, Mr. Worldly Wise Man next asked him, "Well, do you have a wife and children?" Continuing to show interest in Christian. And after Christian told him about his wife and children, how he wasn't able to even enjoy them anymore because of this burden that was on his back, Mr. Worldly Wise Man asked him, "Well, if I give you some advice, would you listen to me?" And of course, Christian says, "Well, if it's good advice, I'll listen to you." And at that point, Mr. Worldly Wise Man says, "Well, here's what you need to do. You need to get this burden off of your back." Well, Christian said, "That's exactly what I intend to do." And then he asked him, "Well, who advised you in the manner that you're trying to get the burden off your back? Who told you to do this?" And of course, Christian answered truthfully and told him he had met a man named Evangelist. And notice, perhaps you noticed how Worldly Wise Man responds by trying to destroy Christian's confidence in Evangelist. Mr. Worldly Wise Man curses Evangelist, and he curses the way that Evangelist instructed Christian to be free from his burden by saying, "It's foolish to go through so many hardships to rid yourself of a burden when it can be done a whole lot easier." And then finally, he asked him, "Well, how did you come to get this burden in the first place?" And Christian told him, "It was by reading this book that's in my hand." And before Mr. Worldly Wise Man actually goes into giving Christian the counsel that he's going to give him, he makes one last attempt to destroy Christian's confidence, even in the book that's in his hand, even in the Bible. Notice what Mr. Worldly Wise Man says. He says, "Christian answered, by reading this book in my hand." "I thought so," said Worldly. "It's happened to you as to other weak men who suddenly fall into such distractions by meddling with things too high for them. Those distractions not only strip men of their manliness, as I perceive they have done to you, but also cause them to undertake desperate ventures to obtain things they know nothing about." Two things. If you want to get to a man, the first thing you can do is call his manliness into question, right? Mr. Worldly Wise Man uses worldly wisdom to call his manhood into question. He says that the manliest of men aren't the type of men who are distracted by such a burden, right? Christian, emotions aren't manly. those who are distracted in their heart and soul by the teaching of this book, they are weaklings. According to worldly wise men, strong people, manly men, act as though things are fine and good even when they aren't. Strong people don't show their weaknesses. Real men don't walk around upset about their feelings. They suppress their feelings until their heart is so hardened that they really don't feel it anymore. That's what a man does. Many people have speculated as exactly who Mr. Worldly Wise Man was supposed to be. Everybody that I've looked at tended to agree that there was a famous bishop during the time that Bunyan lived who advocated and taught these very same things that Mr. Worldly Wise Man is representing. So it's likely that there was actually a real person who inspired Bunyan with this character. But in the story, Mr. Worldly Wise Man goes, if you notice, he also had something to say about the fact that the things in this book are just too high for this low little man to read. He's basically given the argument, listen, leave the stuff in this book to the bishops. Leave it to the clergy. You haven't even been to seminary. Don't try to handle this stuff yet. You can't read Greek or Hebrew. Leave this to the bishops. Mr. Worldly Wise Man went on to say, but why seek for ease this way, seeing so many dangers accompany it? Especially since if you just have patience to hear me, I could direct you to ways of obtaining what you desire without the dangers to which you'll expose yourself in the way you're going. Yes, and the solution is apparent. Besides, you also would then meet with much safety, friendship, contentment. Please, sir, reveal this secret to me, said Christian. Worldly began his advice. Why, over in the village over there, the one named Morality, there dwells a gentleman whose name is Legality. He's a very judicious man with a good name. An individual who has skill to help people remove from their shoulders burdens like yours. He has done a great deal of good this way. So also he has the skill to cure those who are driven a little insane by their burdens. As I said, you may go to him and receive help immediately. His house is not even quite a mile from here. If he isn't at home himself, he has a handsome son whose name is Civility. He can do it as well as the old gentleman himself. There, I say, you may be eased of your burden. And if you desire to return to your... If you don't desire to return to your former residence, as I certainly wouldn't encourage you to do, you may send for your wife and children to come into this village. In Morality, there are houses now standing empty, one of which you could lease at a reasonable rate. Food and supplies there are cheap and good, and to be sure, what will make your life even more happy is that you'll live by honest neighbors with favor and in style. Mr. Worldly Wise Man knows that a man like Christian, who's leaving the sinful life of the city, wouldn't want to go back there. And Mr. Worldly Wise Man wouldn't advise it. I mean, why would you? Why live there when you can move out of the city to a village where you never have to lock your doors again? It would be a great place to live. The citizens there are noble. Everyone is so nice. They all homeschool their children, whom I might add are super obedient and well-mannered. Right-wing Republicans are the most liberal among them. And as far as modesty goes, they make the Amish feel ashamed. Both Legality and his son Civility are men of high repute, well-behaved, orderly. the appearance of this society is that of respectability, politeness, and good order. Lawlessness is not tolerated in morality, while neighborliness is applauded. The inhabitants are mostly regular church-going folk. The standard of living is high. The cost of living is low. Family values are extolled. A fine house stands empty, ready for occupation by Christian and his family at the most reasonable rent. The neighbors are financially stable and fashionable. We shouldn't be surprised that after some consideration, Christian made his decision. Which way is this honest man's home? Do you see that hill right over there? Worldly wise man asked. You must go by that. And the first house you come to, that's his. As we've seen already, have we seen parallels before? This part of Christian's journey to the wicket gate also parallels the same type of distraction that John Bunyan encountered in his life. Listen to how he describes it for us. Wherefore, I fell to some outward reformation, both in my words and life, and did set the commandments before me for my way to heaven, which commandments I also did strive to keep, and, as I thought, did keep them pretty well at times. And then I should have comfort. Yet now and then should break one, and so my conscience afflicted me. But then I should repent and say, I'm sorry for it, promise God to do better next time, and there get help again. For then I thought I pleased God as well as any man in England. Let me pause right there, a side note, and say, Bunyan is a perfect illustration here, whether we are Christians or not Christians, of someone who most certainly is misapplying the law and seeking righteousness by it as opposed to resting in Christ. If when you're doing well, you have comfort and joy, but when you didn't obey well, you get all down and sad, it should be a clear indication to us that legalism is reigning in our heart. But let me go on with Bunyan's comments. He says, thus I continued about a year, all which time our neighbors did take me to be a very godly man, a new and religious man, and did marvel much to see such a great and famous alteration in my life and manners. And indeed so it was, though yet I knew not Christ, nor grace, nor faith, nor hope. As I have well since seen, then, had I died then, my state would have been most fearful. But I say, my neighbors were amazed at my great conversion, from profaneness to something like a moral life. And truly, so they well might, for this my conversion was great. Now, therefore, they began to praise, to commend, to speak well of me, both to my face and behind my back. Now I was, as they said, become godly. Now I was become a right honest man. But oh, when I understood these were their words and opinions of me, it pleased me mighty well. For though as yet I was nothing but a poor painted hypocrite, yet I loved to be talked of as one of them that was truly godly. I was proud of my godliness. And indeed, I did all I did, either to be seen of or to be spoken well of by men, and thus I continued for about 12 months. So Christian turned, Bunyan tells us, out of the way and went towards Mr. Legality's house for help. Worldly wise man is so deceptive. The reason he's so deceptive is because the very things that he was telling Christian are the very things that we're all inclined to think. Because his advice makes sense. If we look at the world without faith, The advice that Mr. Worldly Wiseman gives is easy to understand. It's why we're so prone to lean upon our own understanding. It just seems right. And the Bible would agree. There is a way that seems right to a man. But in the end, it leads to death. But with clever deception, this poor pilgrim is led to believe that passing over such a mountain is easily attainable. But what he doesn't realize is that this high hill is in fact as lofty as the perfect righteousness of God. Can Christian, with such a burden on his back, really climb to that height? Well, we're told that when he reached the hill, it seemed so high. And the side of the hill that was next to the pathway had such a great overhang that Christian was afraid to go farther lest the hill should fall on his head. So he stood still, not knowing what to do. Also, his burden now seemed heavier to him than it was while he was in his original course of travel. Flashes of fire came out of the hill, making Christian afraid he would be burned. Here, therefore, he sweat and shook with fear, and now he began to be sorry that he had taken this advice. It was at this point when Christian looks up and sees a familiar face on the horizon. He sees Evangelist, you know, the one at the very beginning who saw Christian in the field before we even knew his name was Christian, and approached him and told him, "Do you see that gate over there?" The same Evangelist. We're told that Christian was ashamed to look up, even blushed when Evangelist drew near to him. Evangelist began to speak and said he also had some questions. "What are you doing here? Aren't you the man that I found crying outside of the city of destruction? Didn't I advise you of the way to the small, narrow gate? How is it that you so quickly turned aside? For you're now out of the way." Christian began to explain of what happened. "As soon as I got through the swamp, I met this man, this gentleman, who convinced me that I could find someone in this city, in this village, to take my burden. So I came here. But when I saw this hill and how it hangs over the pathway, I stopped because of fear that it was going to fall on my head." Christian went on to tell Evangelist of all the things that Mr. Worldly Wiseman had asked him and told him to do. And as Christian stood there trembling, Evangelist said, "Listen to what I'm about to say to you. My righteous one will live by faith. And if he shrinks back, I will not be pleased with him." And likely in the same tone that Jonathan used with David, the evangelist says, "You are that man who's running into misery. You have rejected the counsel of God and turned out of the way." Christian fell down and cried out, "Woe to me, I am ruined." But Evangelist wasn't done. He picks him up and says, "All the sins and blasphemies of men will be forgiven them. Stop doubting and believe." And it was at this point when Evangelist would finally interpret to Christian, help Christian understand everything that he had just been through and experienced. He said, "The man that you met is called Worldly Wiseman. He's rightly called that partly because he finds only the doctrine of this world tasteful. He goes to the town of morality to attend church, and partly because the doctrine he loves the most is that which saves him from the suffering associated with the cross." Worldly wise man is just that. He's worldly wise because he just isn't able to taste or feel or to see the things that are only experienced by faith. He's only able to know the pleasures of this world. He lives by sight, not by faith. And this is the way of all the world. But evangelist told him, there are three things particularly that you ought to despise about the counsel of Mr. Worldly Wise Man. The first thing is his act of turning you out of the way. The Lord told you, evangelist told Christian, the Lord told you, make every effort to enter into the narrow door, which is the door I sent you to. Small is the gate, narrow is the road that leads to life, and only few find it. And this wicked man has turned you away from the gate. You should despise that counsel, but you should also, he tells him, despise yourself for listening to it. The second thing he says is that you should despise is the fact that his work to make the cross offensive to you. You must despise his work to make the cross offensive to you. You must consider the cross of greater value than all the treasures of Egypt. Mr. Worldly Wise Man holds up comfort and ease and pleasure and riches and of this world as something to distract Christian away from the cross. The work of Mr. Worldly Wise Man isn't just that he's indifferent to the cross. He is opposed to the cross. We'll see this more in a moment. The third thing that he should despise about the counsel of Mr. Worldly Wise Man is that he was setting your feet on the path that leads to the administration of death. This is what he says precisely. And for this, you must consider to him to whom you must consider to whom he sent you, and also how unable that person was to deliver you from your burden. Evangelist continues saying, he to whom you were sent to find ease is named Legality. He is the son of a slave woman that now exists and who is in bondage with her children. The slave woman is symbolic of Mount Sinai. This mountain you feared would fall on your head. Now, if she and her children are in bondage, how can you expect to be made free by them? Therefore, Legality is not able to set you free from your burden. No one has ever been delivered from his burden by him. No, nor is it ever likely to happen. You can't be justified by works of the law, for no one living can be loosed from his burden by the deeds of the law. This explanation from evangelist helps explain Christian's experience. Instead of getting relief from his burden, it only became heavier. He was so overcome with fear that he was paralyzed. He didn't know what to do. You see, what evangelist would have Christian to know about the path that he was on is that in reality, God's unbridled law doesn't wrap you up in a snuggy blanket to make you comfortable. It picks you up by the scruff of your neck and kicks your butt all around the block. God's law doesn't offer life. It bludgeons you to death. It doesn't offer comfort. It points its 10-foot-long bony finger in your face. It wakes you up in the morning, half asleep, to wonder, why am I such a mess? Am I even a Christian? Because the law is merciless. It doesn't let you off the hook. It doesn't pat you on the back. It judges your every move. It doesn't come to save you. It comes to condemn you and to throw you into prison. It kills and it accuses and it curses everything that's not in Jesus Christ. We have not and cannot live up to its demands. And yet the law is still there, holding up a mirror to show me all of my sin and all of my failures. And this is a good thing, because it's still God's will for me. It's still God's standard for me. The law shows me what is good for me. The law shows me what is good for my neighbor. It shows me the righteous character of God, and it shows me what I'm not. Because the law is about bondage. The spirit of bondage is the spirit of fear. We all stand before God as it were, on a mountain. And what we find is this. If you stand before God on the Mount Sinai, you will find God a judge and man a convicted criminal. But on Mount Calvary, you will find God as a father and man as the adopted son of his love. And this is a perfect love that casts out all fear. Christian has found out the hard way that the way of the transgressor is hard. But the self-righteous spirit will choose to stand beneath Sinai rather than look to Calvary. Mr. Worldly Wise Man's counsel seems so right, but in the end, it always proves to be so wrong. It's not by making the best of our diseased condition that we can obtain life, but by seeing and knowing the worst of our state and then fleeing to refuge, to lay hold of the hope, the only hope that is set before us. Worldly wise man suggested self-justification rather than self-condemnation. He suggested forgetfulness of sin rather than forgiveness of sin. And to help in all of this work, experience tells us that all the citizens of morality and carnal policy are thoroughly trained in the fine art of tailor-made excuses, psychological guilt explanations, and frequent reminders of compensating personal merit. But even in light of all this, in the end, Mr. Worldly Wise Man is an alien. Mr. Legality is a cheat. And as for his son's civility, even though many people desire their children to grow up and be just like him because he's so impressive, nevertheless, he's nothing but a hypocrite and he cannot help you. After this, to confirm to Christian all that he had just said, evangelist called aloud for the heavens to confirm what he said. And with that, we're told that fire came out of the mountain, and they heard a voice come from heaven and said, "All who rely on observing the law are under a curse. For it is written, 'Cursed is everyone who does not continue to do everything written in the book of the law.'" And Christian was disturbed. "What do you think, sir? Is there any hope? May I go back and go up to the narrow gate? I'm sorry I listened to this man's advice, but may my sin be forgiven." At this point, I find evangelist comment the most striking. Here's what he says. "Your sin is very great." Really? Very great? I mean, do we really agree with evangelist's counsel here? I mean, what was Christian doing? Bunyan tells us in his biography what he was doing. He was doing his best to obey the commandments. And he was doing a really good job of it too, he said. Everybody was talking about how godly he was. Is this really what great sin looks like? Let me compare another scene in the story that's coming up later. I've done this before. At the same point in the pilgrimage, between the Slough of Despond and the Wicket Gate, we'll later hear that Faithful meets someone at this point too. Faithful doesn't meet Worldly Wise Man. Faithful told Christian at this point in the pilgrimage, instead, he was approached by a woman named Wanton. The same lady, he said, who was Potiphar's wife, who had approached Joseph many years before and tried to persuade him to come to her house to be with her. Faithful said the temptation was so great that he almost went with her until he remembered some words that he had previously read. The steps to her house lead to the grave. Why bring this up? Here's why. Because if Faithful would have given in to that temptation and sinned with Wanton and was confronted by Evangelist as Christian was, and if Evangelist would have gone on to describe Faithful's sin as very great, I think we would have all seen that coming. It would have been easier to understand. It's why some parents are devastated the first time they find out their son looks at pornography, but isn't that concern if they even notice his self-righteousness? It's because deep down, we don't believe what Evangelist says. What Christian did seemed so right. How could it be so wrong? What was he doing seemed so right? I wouldn't have been surprised if Evangelist would have said this: Christian, keep doing everything you're doing. Just do it on the way. But he doesn't say that. You have to leave this way to go to this way. I remember years back in school, I had a good friend. One of the closest friends I've ever had. He wasn't a Christian, and he didn't claim to be a Christian. But I remember discussing his lost condition with another mutual friend. And this friend would often say something that would always leave me feeling, I don't know about that. That just doesn't sound right. But I wasn't sure why. But this friend would always say, he's already such a great person. If he were to just get saved, really he wouldn't have to change anything. I couldn't put my finger exactly on why. But I think now I know. In our conservative Christian culture, we applaud Phariseeism. It's impressive to us. We call it Christian maturity. Just like the people in Bunyan's day, they called it godliness. When we see Mr. Worldly Wise Man keeping all the conservative rules, we hold him up as the example. But the problem is that it's most often based on a false concept of spirituality. Its focus is on what I do rather than my heart's relationship to God. And Paul tells the Galatians, the only thing that counts is faith working through love. But Mr. Worldly Wise Man disagrees. The only thing that matters to him is that you appear to be doing the right thing. Bunyan, the Apostle Paul, and I believe God would say, to look to the law, to look to our perceived obedience to the law, to try to bring comfort and peace to our hearts, is a serious and very great evil in the sight of God. God hates it. Paul says, if anyone teaches that kind of gospel, let him be accursed. It cannot save, it cannot justify, it cannot satisfy, it cannot sanctify. By the law comes the knowledge of sin, but we are not saved by the law. We're saved apart from the law by the righteousness that's given to us by God's grace and through Jesus Christ. Though your sin is great, and then Evangelist says this, yet the man at the gate will receive you. He favors mankind. He favors mankind. Let me leave you with a question. Does your counsel, the counsel you give, do you tend to sound more like worldly wise man or evangelist? From your counsel, what does it appear you love more? Sinai or Calvary? Where do you point those who are burdened by sin and are hurting? Parents, are your children more indoctrinated in the laws of Sinai or the grace of Calvary? Does your ministry reflect more of Moses or of Jesus? Because one of them is a ministry of life and one of them is a ministry of death. I'll admit it's much more natural to point to Sinai, to harp over and over about the things we do wrong. But there's a better word to offer. All the sins of man will be forgiven them. Stop doubting and believe. Come without money and buy. Come all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved. Brothers and sisters and friends, if we will give up on ourselves and all of our promises to do better, there is a man standing at the wicket gate who waits for you. And it's the same one who gave the law, but not to distract you, to point you to himself. And at the wicket gate, he waits for you, and he promised to receive you. For he favors mankind. Why don't you pray with me? Father, would you give your grace, give us grace, that our eyes would be opened afresh, that we might be able to make this pilgrimage with spiritual eyes. Lord, make us ready to see. Make us ready to believe. Help us to be so mindful of your kingdom, in such pursuit of your kingdom, that any of Mr. Worldly Wise Man's counsel will be obvious to us. Set our hearts in such a flame with love for you that any thought or hint of our own righteousness would be so distasteful from our mouth that we would spit it out immediately and confess yet again, my righteousness is in heaven. Convince us of this, O Lord. I would ask for your glory, O God, would you please do it? Amen. Next week, we will look at Christian approaching and going into the wicket gate. So why don't you read through that, and we'll pick up there next week.